Could the world be headed for the next big financial crisis?
You've been looking at your super balance or something this morning, Geraldine. For anyone keeping an eye on the markets, it's a very live question right now, given just how unpredictable global politics have become.
I mean, there are a lot of reasons for uncertainty, but perhaps the biggest is this idea of an AI bubble, which may be artificially propping up the economy and masking some of the impacts of Donald Trump's tariffs.
And so, if this is a bubble, what happens to the rest of us when it bursts?
I'm Geraldine Duke.
I'm Hamish McDonald.
And welcome to this bonus episode of Global Roaming. Yes, Hamish, I'm not one, as you know, to sow unnecessary fear. I don't like doing that, but there really are some increasingly loud warnings, building to a bit of a roar, to be honest, over whether a big financial meltdown is imminent.
And much of the focus is on the level of investment that is swirling around in the AI market. I mean, this is not the sole cause of concern, but I think for anyone that takes even a vague interest in looking at what's going on in the markets, I think there's been a fair degree of surprise that the tariffs introduced by the Trump administration don't seem to have caused as much damage to the global economy, at least for now, than what was initially expected. And in part, the explanation seems to be that all of the excitement around AI is still stimulating enough economic growth that perhaps we're slightly blinded to the realities of the moment.
Yes, virtually all the supposed growth, you know, in the US economy is underpinned by the rise in the value of these big AI firms. And, you know, there's just a phenomenal amount of money being ladled into them. Even our own Reserve Bank Governor, Michelle Bullock, just said yesterday she's a bit stunned at how, quote, sanguine brokers are about the frothiness on display. But the amazing part of it is that their stock price goes up and up and up. Their revenue doesn't. And that's the conundrum. You know, like Microsoft's market capitalization has gone up 145% in the past 3 years, but the money they're actually making falls a lot short of that. So, you know, this is not the way capitalism is supposed to work. It does occasionally work like that. You know, you get an enormous sense of, like, because there is a debate underway. Do you have to be in it to win it? Do you have to be on board the AI investment train in order to be there at the end when allegedly, you know, it'll be the equivalent of the railroads or more? Or is it that somebody at some point is going to put their hands up, as people said in the Financial Review this week, and say, hey, where has all the money gone? Where has all my money, and I'm investing on behalf of other people whose whole retirement rests on this, where has that money gone? And that's when you get your crash.
I mean, maybe those theories about the underlying drivers of economic growth are being tested in all sorts of ways, not just this. Like, if you look at the growth of crypto, the whole question about crypto is, how do you have a genuine investment if it's not underpinned by something solid? And, you know, I guess you could draw a comparison between that and what you're describing here with businesses that have massive stock price growth, but they're not actually increased value or increased production or output. I always love watching Alan Kohler. We all do, but particularly for those little graphs that he brings up from time to time. And I thought it was worth for listeners drawing in one of those little moments where Alan actually looks at how much the growth of the AI investment is driving broader growth in the US economy.
AI company Nvidia, which makes the chips, is up from $11 to $180 in 3 years, and it's doubled in 6 months. The top 10 AI companies have been responsible for pretty much all of the US market's gains over the past couple of years and are now worth collectively $35 trillion. So it's basically AI is holding up both the stock market and the US economy.
And it makes bankers like JP Morgan's Jamie Dimon, for instance, extremely nervous.
I am far more worried about that than others. So if you said, now I'm talking about probabilities, I would give it a higher probability than I think is probably priced in the market and by others. No. So if the market's pricing in 10%, I would say it's more like 30. And
I'm not saying one third chance of a correction.
Yeah, and I'm not saying next year. Because the timing of these things is almost impossible to figure out.
So it could be what, 6 months? Could be a year?
Could be 6 months, could be 2 years. The amount of uncertainty, and I put geopolitics in that category, fiscal spend that category, politics in that category, the remilitarization of the world in that category, all these things cause a lot of issues that we don't know how they're going to sort out. So I'd say the level of uncertainty should be higher in most people's minds than what I call normal.
Yeah, Jamie Dimon, they're not necessarily instilling you with a whole heap of confidence. Just on that, Geraldine, do you know how much NVIDIA is valued at the moment? Just this one company.
What is it? Tell me.
So I think back in middle of the year, a $4 trillion company,
yeah,
they were saying.
It's sort of
well
absurd.
Over that now, they say. Kind of almost unmanageable numbers if you're trying to sort of think about the value of a company. I think the other thing worth weaving into this conversation before we get to your interview, Geraldine, is that the IMF is really ringing the alarm about the private credit sector. This is sort of the explosion of private credit, so non-bank lenders. It sort of meant a liberalisation of the way money flows around. But if you think back to the global financial crisis, you know, subprime mortgages, these complex debt structures, there are some people saying that there's now a kind of shadow banking system which doesn't necessarily have all of the same lending requirements.
It's true. But sorry to interrupt. But it is. It's also this is yet another debate. You know, I just noticed that Guy Debelle, who played an enormously important role, he was previously number two at the Reserve Bank during our GFC. He just wrote this week that actually one of the reforms they wanted out of the GFC was for more private credit to enter the picture, so that it wasn't just banks whom they had to remember they had to underwrite, do a lender of last resort. They wanted more to come into the picture to enable money to be circulated.
But
now,
it's a question of whether...
It's a question of degree, of course.
And also whether those new lenders that have entered the market are behaving responsibly.
Oh,
and
totally.
Whether we understand how much debt exposure they have. Because I suppose this is the question, the prudential regulations that we might see imposed on banks here in Australia may not be the same sort of onerous levels of liquidity, for example, that we might want, and we can't even see what's necessarily going on inside that shadow banking sector, which is what it's being called.
He seemed to be saying that in fact it didn't have the sort of, you know, extraordinary Ponzi like schemes that happened during the GFC, but let's hope so. And why does this matter for us here in Australia? I mean, turns out we're very exposed to this. In fact, I'd like you to listen to the ABC's Michael Yander talking about the particular exposure of the superannuation sector, and I think it's worth hearing.
With over $4.3 trillion now in Australian super, it's simply too much money to invest locally. So our super funds have increasingly been investing offshore, particularly in the US, and there is huge concentration in the big tech stocks in the US, which are again priced for perfection. If one of these big risks materialises, economic growth slows down, those tech valuations are no longer justified, you could have super funds wearing big losses, you could have super investors trying to change out of more aggressive strategies into more conservative cash-based investments, and then you might see super funds having to liquidate a lot of assets into a falling market, and with that much money on the table, that could accentuate the falls in those asset markets.
Well, pretty scary, I would say, listening to that from Michael Yander, particularly if you're kind of conscious of your super balance. And I've got to tell you, Geraldine, with Kevin Rudd in Australia this week talking about exactly this, that, you know, the Australian super sector is looking for more things to invest in and that the US is a market ripe for opportunity. That's the way, you know, it's described as opportunity. Earlier in the year, the treasurer, the big super funds, the super sector over in America looking for, I think a lot of it is capital works infrastructure to invest in because so much of it is ailing in the United States. I would note to you that whenever this has come up on my morning radio show over the last couple of weeks, listeners pretty horrified at the thought of their super being discussed as part of the geopolitical conversation. You know,
are they?
Anthony Albanese at the White House talking to Trump about the value of our super funds to him, to the United States. People saying, whoa. You know, why is my super being discussed in that context? Now, Jacob Greber made the point to me, look, you know, there's still very strong fiduciary duties, the super funds, there's no change to that. But it is unusual, I think, that it's being discussed in that way at that level.
Oh, Isn't that funny? I see it. I understand people's caution because we're not used to it. But it's actually one of the ways in which we play at the big table. It is actually very much, I think, Australia stepping up. This is, I mean, it was an unintended consequence of Bill Keltie and Paul Keating setting up that fund back in 1987, you know, the compulsory super. But actually what it has done is enable us to really sit at some very big tables, which matter. I mean, economic strength underpins geopolitical strength, you know? People have got to realise that.
I think it's just surprised many people to hear that their super is being discussed in that way. I mean, I'd love to hear from our listeners, global.roaming@abc.net.au. How do you feel about your super being discussed within that kind of geopolitical domain? I think the other thing to flag, Geraldine, before we get to the interview, of course, we're having this conversation in the days leading up to a meeting between Xi Jinping and Donald Trump about trade, about tariffs. And I guess so much of this conversation rests on the outcome of a meeting like that, or at least will be influenced by the outcome of a meeting like that.
Yes, well, certainly this is what our guest today is perusing very, very closely, the Irish economist David McWilliams. He's well known in Ireland for having forecast the 2008 financial crash, predicting the first Trump election and the strong Brexit vote. He was a central banker himself. These days, he's an economics commentator, and I think you'll find a very entertaining one. He was here in Australia to promote his new book, Money, A Story of Humanity, and I managed to sit down with him in person one morning to chat about whether he thinks we are headed for a financial crash of some sort. David McWilliams, welcome to Australia.
It's absolutely gorgeous to be here, Geraldine. It's absolutely fantastic. It's funny, Aussies, when you go abroad, you never talk about it. You say, well, what's going on in Australia? Oh, nothing much, you know. Then you arrive here and it's...
Oh, there's a lot. Thank you.
It's so energetic and it's an irrepressible culture. It's great fun. Love it.
You'll go
love
far.
It.
You will go far. We love hearing that sort of thing. Now, look, you're known for accurately forecasting the Brexit vote in the UK, the Trump victory and the 2008 global crash. Now, as I speak to you this morning, there are all sorts of new fears about a looming economic crash, whether we're meeting another version of the Lehman moment when that merchant bank fell over in 2008, ushering in all the chaos that it did. Do you think we're heading for anything similar?
I think, Geraldine, what people need to appreciate is every now and then the world goes through these massive super cycles, not just economic cycles, but super cycles that can last a couple of decades, and they are political, they're economic, they're technological, they're cultural. And I think we're at a tipping point between one cycle and another cycle. So, for example, 1945 to about 1990, you had a super cycle after the Second World War, where you had the Cold War, you had managed trade, you had managed capital flows, you hadn't that much technological transfer, you had alliances, etc. And then from about 1990 to now, we've had this new period of globalization, where the borders are open, where money's flowing around, where ideas are flowing around. It's the internet age. It's the age of American dominance. And I think now what we're going through is something like we had in 1990, where one period, the Cold War, is coming to an end, and now this period, globalization, is coming to an end. Mm-hmm. And what we have is new alliances, new technology. We're going from, for example, in the case of Europe, we had open borders, we're now going to close borders. We went from open trade, we're now going to tariffs. We went from small government, we're now going to big government. So what people have to grasp is that why people feel anxious is because we are going from one big shift to another. And of course, during those periods, mistakes happen, problems happen. And this is where I believe that we're seeing lots and lots of individuals collectively thinking, are we going to another crash?
Well, what is also I think that's probably a very correct diagnosis, but there can be lots of money lost, can't there, and made, I suppose, in these types of moments.
Absolutely.
And one of the things that has happened in the last little while, people like Jamie Dimon, you know, the venerable Jamie Dimon from JP Morgan, sort of looking at all these various layers of debt that are being built up as really in between the source of money and the way it's used.
Yes.
And that you just, if you were lending money or someone was coming to you and saying, well, look, this is, I've got a cert for you, an absolute certainty, You wouldn't know what you were lending to. Now, that is, capitalism can't work like that, can it?
Look, you've put your finger on something extraordinary, which is that we have been dealing with money for thousands of years. But when you actually strip it back, very few of us understand how potent, how dangerous, how extraordinarily flamboyant this substance is. Now, I think one of the problems is that, you know, economists are tend to be the people who are charged with discussing money. And, you know, when economists see a price, they see a number. Mm. But when real people see a price, they get a feeling. And it's the feeling that drives markets. And it's us humans who drive markets. And the interesting thing about us humans is we're completely irrational. So what you're seeing, what Jamie Dimon is talking about, is A...
And the head of the Bank of England too.
And the head of the Bank of England is A, the extraordinary change in finance that is going on. Mm-hmm. And B, it is the impact of money on human psychology, which makes us completely effervescent on the upside and completely depressed on the downside. And the interesting thing is, Geraldine, we do this together because we are a social animal. So when you get optimistic, that infects me. Mm. And I see this in the, you know, in the Aussie property market I'm looking around. I haven't had a conversation in this country in the last 2 weeks that hasn't settled on, oh my God, you know. So what you have, and this is because we are social, so we get infected on the upside and on the downside. And what we're seeing across AI, across stock markets, etc., is the excitable human being getting irrationally optimistic on the upside.
Well, that's the trouble. If it becomes a merry-go-round, and which is exactly what happened, we discovered in 2008.
Yes.
And I mean, really, that was just short of a pretty much a catastrophe worldwide. And are we at that point now? That's, you know, ought wise people be really pulling back?
Yeah,
do you think they should?
Yeah, because look, if you look, for example, take the issue that most people are focusing on now, which is AI in America. Mm. This extraordinary, you know, people use the word unprecedented, like it hasn't happened before, but it hasn't happened before. This amount of money going into one technology in a concentrated fashion by a few players with vast access to finance.
Lending to each other in round robins.
This lending is what to each other.
Honestly,
exactly.
Frightens me.
Well, that's exactly the Lehman moment. What actually happened in 2008, and one of the reasons that maybe people like I were forecasting it, was the banks didn't even know who they were lending to, not externally, but within the banks themselves, because the banks are all these silos. So if you look at, for example, in the United States now, there is a massive boom in data centers, right? Now, data centers are just buildings, and inside the building are chips, microchips, and that's it. And the problem with those chips, or they call them GPUs, right, is that all these American companies are trying to create faster and faster and faster microchips. Now, that means when you're investing in them, you're actually investing in something perishable, because today's microchip is going to be tomorrow's rubbish. So what is actually happening with all these? If you think about it, it's like technological letters or something they're inviting. Yeah. They're doing. So if you think about it, all this money is going into a perishable asset. And the game then is who is going to go bust first and who is going to stay in the game last. And we're talking $300 billion. We know that half of the growth rate of the United States in the first 6 months of this year is attributed directly to AI investment. So you're getting a massive concentration of investment, which means, Geraldine, a massive concentration of risk in a country that is chaotic, that is going through a culture war, that is going through a finance war, that the president is at war with the central bank, the dollar itself is declining. There is a sense in the United States of a country unmoored. And all the while, the big bet is that technology will save America and propel America forward.
And some interesting people, because I read quite a lot about this, they worry, but they also say, I can see why people with money want to be in it, because it's a bit like the arrival of the railroad.
Well, this is the fascinating thing, but the problem with the railroad is we know that railroads precipitated four massive panics over four decades. The first one, amazingly, Charles Darwin lost his shirt. The most incredibly clever man in the world at the time, who could figure out biology and evolution, he lost his shirt. Why? Because understanding money is actually much more complicated than understanding evolution. Exactly, exactly. You know, and so if we come back to it, you know, what you have is all of us saying, and this is the worrying thing, this time it's different. This is a new cycle. Like, take Jamie Dimon. Jamie Dimon, ironically, was a classic AI and crypto skeptic about 2 or 3 years ago. And a crypto skeptic. Now he's full on board. Why? Because the easy money is there. It's a speculative mania. And so what you're seeing is lots and lots of people. Look, Donald Trump was a crypto skeptic. And now he's actually the center of, I would say, a family heist in crypto. Same thing for AI. So what you have is technology always beguiles us. And I think it was, I'm not sure who actually said, I think it was Bill Gates said about technological innovation, we always overestimate its importance in the short run and underestimate its importance in the long run. Meaning that what we're going through is exactly the same as a railway boom or a dot-com boom.
So before we move on, because I want to ask you about a range of things, so you're not waiting for it to fall tomorrow. By the sound of it, you're keeping a weather eye out, are you?
No, I think we're on the cusp of a monumental.
Oh, you do?
Absolutely. Because look what's happened, right? We have valuations that are off the scale in the United States. Let's talk about the United States. The United States is the epicenter of global finance. We can talk about Australia and Europe and all that sort of stuff, but in actual fact, the key theater of risk is the United States. What you have is seven companies are now generating over 40% of all the wealth in sectors of the economy, which are highly concentrated. We have an entire Wall Street apparatus that is focused exclusively on them. So what we're looking at is a massive concentration of risk in one specific area. All the while, the United States have an erratic foreign policy. They have an erratic trade policy. They are creating enemies everywhere. And internally, they're trying to deal with a culture war between Democrats, Republicans, right, left, urban, rural, all that sort of stuff. It seems to me that we are moving relentlessly towards a moment where somebody sticks their hands up and says, hold on a second. Like, you saw gold down 6% yesterday. I mean, these are big moves, right? These are not moves that are normal. These are moves that are entirely erratic. And I think that what we're seeing everywhere is the culmination of 15 to 20 years of easy monetary policy. Mm. You see it here in
Australia.
Money
everywhere.
Money everywhere. Mm. Money being printed everywhere. No real accounting identities. Things are going up, so everyone feels good. We're all optimistic.
Well, the argument is that a lot of the banks, I was going to ask you about resilience, that a lot of the banks have actually are more prudent. Well, certainly they are in Australia post 2008. And I think I even saw the Bank of England bloke saying that it wasn't, we weren't as exposed as we, leaving aside those terrific valuations.
Yeah.
But we weren't as exposed. We had got our act together a little bit.
Jernie, I'm a former central banker. Okay. The easiest way to rob a bank is to run it. Right? Okay.
David, that's very Irish.
It's true. Look, you're from Kilkenny, right? Okay. That's the easiest way to rob a bank is to run it. Banks get robbed from the inside out. Now, why is that? That's what happens. You know, traditionally, when we're kids, we think of a bank robber, a fella with swag and jumps over a wall. That's not how it works. Banks get robbed by their own owners, right? And how do they do this? They lend irrationally. Why do they do this? Because their bonuses and their share prices are related to quantity of lending. So once you understand that banks are robbed from the inside out, that's how you figure out. So again, the Bank of England, and again, I speak as central bank, the dirty little secret of finance, Geraldine, is central bankers are not in control. Now, why is that? Why is that? And this is the eureka moment, right? Is because money is created by commercial banks. So for example, Geraldine, if you decide tomorrow you want to buy a new car, and you think, okay, I'm going to borrow to buy a new car, as everybody does. And you go into your bank and they say, okay, Geraldine, we'll give you 30 grand to buy the car. The 30 grand is put in your account today. It didn't exist tomorrow. It didn't exist yesterday, sorry. So it's not that the commercial bank ring up the central bank and say, oh, I've got this Geraldine here. Do we have permission to give her money? Commercial banks create money out of nothing. That is the magic. So as they create money out of nothing and they don't look for permission, what you have is the central bank pretends it's in control, which is why when we have these periodic crises, the central banker comes on television and says, oh, don't worry, we've got it all covered. And people say, well, no, you don't actually, because my balance sheet has disappeared. So what you've got to understand is that the banking system is the sort of dynamite in the economy. And it's what creates everything. And nobody is in control. We've got a few guardrails. We've got a few notions. But in fact, it is an organic system.
Okay. Now, I'm just going to let listeners know that my guest, Geraldine Doogue, with you for Global Roaming, is David McWilliams, who's terrifying us here. He's an Irish economist and the author most recently of Money, A Story of Humanity. However, you don't want them to put it under their bed, do you? I mean, you're not, well, are you advocating for the fact that no one's in charge? So what do we do?
No, I just think that what we have to understand is that it's human nature to alight upon the notion that, you know, some big boss is in charge. That gives us reassurance, right? And reassurance is what allows us sleep at night, as a general rule in life. But when you study money, when you've worked in the system, what you realize is that nobody's in charge. Yeah, the central bank can raise interest rates and gradually that might change behavior. And gradually you might save a wee bit more and I might borrow a wee bit less if interest rates are high. But that's not control. That's kind of nudging the system. Mm. So that is why we have these volcanic moments periodically. Because the key creature in the game isn't the banker. It's the collective human, us, the economy. And to understand the economy, you've got to understand who makes the decisions, which is this creature, the human being, who is beautifully irrational.
Well, one of the things which is follows this logic, I think, had this incredible phrase, when Trump looks in the mirror, does he see Juan Perón from Argentina smirking back at him? Now, I thought, what are you getting? It was a very powerful little analogy, I thought.
Yeah, I've travelled to Argentina quite a bit, and Argentina's always intrigued me. Not because of their amazing football team, but we can talk about that, but because Argentina, at the end of the Second World War, was the seventh richest country in the world. It is now the 77th richest country in the world. And you think, what happened? An amazing country. In fact, Argentina and Australia were compared very favourably together in the last 100 and 150
they
years.
Were.
Right? Now, what happened in Australia and what happened in Argentina? Right? Similar. It's amazing. Same sort of population. Same broad ethnic source of population from Europe. Same technology.
Same reliance on agriculture.
All that sort of stuff. Mm. What happened in Argentina was relentless and incessant bad management by a populist called Juan Perón, who was married to Evita Perón. Okay. And when I see Donald Trump and I hear him talking about tariffs and I hear him talking about this, that, and the other, I think people compare him to all sorts of things. I think, no, he's more like a Latin American populist from the 1950s. Than any sort of Central European populist that he's compared to. He's much more Latin American. So what I see is that if the United States continues on this journey at a time when China is simply waiting for America to make mistakes, what is most likely is what happened in Argentina to happen in the United States. For example, 100 years ago, the British had an expression, as rich as an Argentine. They were so wealthy, the Argentinians.
And so much promise.
So much promise. And now they are just an abject country going through yet another crisis.
Yes, it is a fascinating thought. I mean, at the moment, if you look at it, there's a 90-day pause on US tariffs placed on imports from China. That's due to expire next month,
yes.
November. There are plans for Xi and Trump to speak at the APEC summit in South Korea in coming days. look, and you feel that there might be a breakthrough there based on Trump's behaviour at a big Australian-American press conference just this week.
I saw that. Yeah. He had a go at your ambassador.
Oh, he did. He did. We all laughed, to be candid. But in fact, Trump was quite sort of unusually emphatic, I thought, in a sort of a confident way about the fact that he thought there would be a breakthrough between him and China. So, I mean, might that be a bit of relief? You're smiling.
It's funny you mentioned the word confident. Confident countries don't introduce tariffs. Think about it. What a tariff is you're admitting that you cannot compete in the open market with your competitor. Insecure countries introduce tariffs because insecure countries want to hide behind barriers. What I think Mr. Trump has an insecurity about the ability of the United States manufacturing sector to compete. And he is right. I mean, what we are seeing is a progressive shift of manufacturing prowess from the West to Asia. That has been going on for the last, let's say, 25 years. It is now accelerating. And the United States, and it's funny we talked about AI. Mm. One of the problems is Mr. Trump wants to bring manufacturing jobs back to the United States. That's fair enough. The problem with AI, because all the investment is going into tech in America, it is elbowing out the amount of investment that can go to manufacturing. So they're strangling their own people. At the same time, they're blaming the Chinese. This is not going to work. So stand back a wee bit. What is happening is not unlike what happened with Britain and Germany at the end of the 19th century, where you have Britain, apparently the big imperial power, but it's the one that's actually declining manufacturing-wise. So the Germans are accelerating rapidly. It's exactly the same as we're having with China and America. We're moving into, we know, it's a cliche, it's the Chinese century. And I think what Mr. Trump is trying to do is slow down that momentum. But he can't stop that momentum. He can't stop it. And the interesting thing is, think about tariffs. The only people who've reacted aggressively to the Americans are the Chinese. They say, you put on 100, we'll put on 100. You put on 200, we'll put on 200. Whereas the Europeans are like, oh, just, you know, give us a break. And you know. So basically, the Chinese are not genuflecting to the Americans. Why? Because they have the power.
David, we'll go away mildly troubled, but it's fantastic to speak to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Not at all. Absolute pleasure, Geraldine.
Jerry, I always enjoy it when you get to the interview, an interview, and it sounds like you've just been shocked.
Again. Oh, I did think there was a bit of a catalogue of gloom, but he does do it entertainingly in a very Irish way.
You enjoyed his Irish sense of humour, I think, a few times during that conversation, even though he tried to butter you up at the beginning by telling you how wonderful Australia is.
Yes, and the Kilkenny allusion, where I've got, you know, one branch of the family comes from.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know whether our banking system is as exposed in Australia as what he's describing. I know he's talking about the broader global economy, and clearly there are questions. I guess I'm also trying to think through in my own mind whether or not the scenario we're facing with these huge quantities of money being thrown around and circled around AI investment, I'm trying to compare that to what we now know about how the global financial crisis unfolded. And I am finding it a bit hard to kind of equate one way or the other. I know he's saying this is bigger, this is unprecedented, there hasn't been anything like this. And, you know, Jamie Dimon, who we heard at the beginning of this, is sort of saying maybe it's not that imminent. You know, maybe it's within a year, if I understood or interpreted him correctly. I suppose the challenge with these things is that it can build and it can build, and then it may only be one small thing, you know, a small lender, for example, that collapses, that then starts to trigger other collapses, right?
Well, that's what happened with those two auto firms that collapsed recently, that actually basically put the wind up the head of the Bank of England and Jamie Dimon, who said, now, hang on, if this is happening, and when we look closely, we couldn't understand the loan structure. Mm. We couldn't understand the loan structure. To me, that was crucial.
So, I you know, the thing that I'm reflecting on, having listened to that conversation, Jerry, is in the wake of the global financial crisis, I got sent to do some reporting on some quite small communities in the far north of Norway in the Arctic Circle. They were sort of you know, oil and gas rich. And the local councils had so much wealth that they'd been investing in all sorts of assets, and then they lost everything. And they essentially didn't, you know, like so many people caught up in that subprime market crash, they didn't know what they'd invested in. So I'm trying to think through now, you know, all of these people that are throwing money into tech stocks, is it the same? Yeah. You know, in 5 years' time, are we going to look back and see communities or sectors or governments that had this kind of exposure to things that they hadn't understood?
Oh, yes. Yes, I think it's unequivocal. Yes. That, but, you know, there's one argument that for the sort of to get the return on investment of what's going into, say, some of these companies, the AI has to sell 10 times the amount that Microsoft Office sells, which is the most successful digital product of all time. 10 times the amount of that. Is that vaguely realistic? I don't think it is.
Yeah, I mean, I obviously want to be absolutely clear that none of this is financial advice, and there are, don't come anywhere near us. And I would say, I mean, Geraldine's going to be fine anyway because she's got her. You've got your entire super invested in Dogecoin, don't you? You'll be totally fine. I mean, you've bought some of those Trump coins as well.
Anthony Scaramucci, I took his advice.
Did you? You didn't really, did you?
No, I did. Of course I didn't. You know me. Heavens.
Our main episode this week is going to be looking at the Trump-Xi meeting. We're really excited. We've got a very special guest lined up for you. When the main episode drops, Bilahari Karsakan.
Looking forward to this.
You've wanted us to interview him ever since global roaming started.
I have. He's a very wise old soul from the Southeast Asian region, a Singaporean diplomat, a venerable thinker, a beautiful thinker, actually. I think we'll really enjoy it.
Global.roaming@abc.net.au is our email address. Thanks to our producer, Taryn Priyadko. Geraldine, I'll leave you to your Doge app.
I'll leave you counting your money.